The Guardian.
There have been highs and many, many lows for all parties throughout this general election campaign, but who will come out on top? I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
I have every sympathy with families.
You refuse to look at the photo. You've taken my phone, put it in your pocket, Prime Minister.
His mother. Tory advisers were scrambling from the get-go this week as Boris Johnson seemed to lose all sense of the word empathy when responding to a photo of a four-year-old boy lying on the floor in a hospital in Leeds. In the hours and days that followed, Johnson seemed to put the BBC on notice when he claimed he was looking at abolishing the licence fee. And later, his aides spread a false rumour that one of the Health Secretary's advisers was punched by a Labour activist, which spread wildly on Twitter. And in a cringeworthy stunt at a factory, the Prime Minister used a Get Brexit Done JCB to mow down a wall of polystyrene blocks marked gridlock. Now, Corbyn's advisers should have been rubbing their hands with glee, but instead, a leaked recording of the Shadow Health Secretary appearing to say that his party had little chance of winning gave the Conservatives a chance to hit back.
You know, I'm trying to sort of, you know, pull his leg a bit, as it were.
So hang on, let's be clear. When you said the party effed it up when they failed to get rid of Corbyn, you didn't mean that either?
No, I'm pulling it.
And the much-anticipated YouGov poll showed that the chances of a Tory majority have narrowed with only a day to go. But as the 2019 general election draws to a close, it might be time for some serious reflection in UK politics. Over the past 6 weeks, we've seen party members turn against each other, discrimination rear its ugly head, lies spread from politicians' pulpits, and candidates dodge the simplest of questions. All the while, weary voters look on and ask, who is the best of this lot? So will this be the election to bring about a fundamental change to our voting system, or is it too late? Can politics ever come back from such a negative election? We look into that and more in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, I've spent a lot of time following Boris Johnson throughout this campaign, but today it's the political editor Heather Stewart's turn. I rang her earlier on to see what the mood is like on the Tory battle bus 24 hours before voters head to the polls.
Well, hectic is one thing to say. So Boris Johnson is very keen to give the impression that he's sort of very up for it, full of energy, ready to crisscross the country and fight for every vote is the sort of general message. And to put that message across, where we're travelling 500 miles today. We started in Yorkshire this morning, very early start, 5:45, and where he sort of delivered a crate of milk to a householder's door with a sort of visual metaphor. I can deliver some milk, I can also deliver Brexit. We were then in Derby, where he helped to make a pie, which was oven ready. So we're sort of in very simplistic visual metaphor.
Dear. It's all a bit cringeworthy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I fear there may be worse to come before the day is over. We've now just touched down in Wales. We took a quick plane flight. But it's very, very tightly controlled here. Less access, I think, than you've had to the Prime Minister on your trips, which I think is probably partly because of that rather chaotic day there was on Monday, where there were a few mishaps. And there was also a strange incident this morning where a Good Morning Britain reporter turned up on spec at this very early morning, sort of pre-dawn trip to a dairy, and tried to get an interview with the Prime Minister, tried to get near him with a microphone, and his press secretary sort of stood in the way and it was caught on live TV saying, for F's sake, and that sort of very quickly blew up into an online story. Is he sort of hiding from scrutiny? He was going in and out of a sort of fridge where the milk was being stored. And so, you know, even before breakfast, there was a sort of Boris Johnson hiding from scrutiny in the fridge tale, which just shows you why they want to sort of manage it so tightly.
Earlier in the week, the Prime Minister was looking pretty chipper and upbeat and cheery. Is he seeming a bit more bruised after the past few days of gaffes?
Yeah, a little bit. I think he's probably tired. We all are. And I think there's a bit of a sense of going through the motions. So we had quite a sort of evening rally last night in Manchester. He gave his speech, but it felt almost as if it was so well rehearsed and he'd done it so many times. There was a sort of slightly pantomimey aspect to it. A little bit of sort of going through the motions and playing it for applause. And I don't know, not quite sure his heart was really in it. And I think they are nervous about this narrowing in the polls and this feeling that these last few days, which perhaps is a moment the politicians will tell you when the public really starts to sort of focus and think, make their decisions and watch what's going on, haven't gone so smoothly for them as the sort of slick middle part of the campaign did.
And what about the advisers that you are spending time with? Are they showing signs of jitters? And did you see any sharp intakes of breath when the YouGov poll was published last night?
Well, so Johnson himself gave the message at an event at JCB yesterday. He said, you know, it's quite, we're playing it for every vote. It's quite possible we could have a hung parliament. You know, we need to fight for this. It's closer than you think. But didn't really feel like he meant that. But looking at that polling, although the Age was saying last night, well, actually, our internal polling is quite cautious. We're not taking this for granted. We're quite scarred by 2017. I think they probably did, in their heart of hearts, believe they had it in the bag. And that's not quite how it looks now.
Where do you think Boris Johnson will be going tomorrow? Is he just back to his constituency to vote? And what's he going to be doing during the day?
That's a good question. I haven't asked, and I will. And now you've said it, I will. But I think, yeah, as for most of the political leaders, I think a quiet day, casting his vote and waiting for the onslaught to come.
Maybe catching up on a bit of sleep.
Yeah, I think we'd all like to do that, wouldn't we?
Well, we'll leave you there, Heather. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thanks, Marina. Cheers.
That was The Guardian's political editor, Heather Stewart. But back in the studio, I am joined by Will Tanner, a former advisor to Theresa May, who is the director of the centre-right think tank Onward, Chris Prosser of the British Election Study, and Jennifer Williams, the politics and investigations editor for the Manchester Evening News, who is joining us down the line. So, Chris, things have gone a bit wrong for both of the main parties so far this week. Do you think in the eyes of the voters, who's come off worse since the Tories' terrible day on Monday?
It's really hard to know how much these things actually matter, to be honest. And I think one of the big things is when you ask people what they've noticed in their campaign, they tend to notice things that were bad for the other side. So if you ask Labour voters, I'm sure they think the Tories have had a terrible week and that, you know, how could anyone possibly vote for them after all these bad things that have happened? But likewise, if you talk to the Conservatives, then the opposite would be true. They'd be pointing at things that Labour have done that haven't gone so well. But whether anyone in the middle has really paid much attention to whatever's happened either way, I think is probably a bit more uncertain.
So at what point do voters really start to engage in an election?
Well, there are some people who, you know, we might call them sort of political hobbyists who are always very, very engaged. But for a lot of people, the closer you get to the election, the sort of more they start to pay attention. And one thing that I think is particularly coming into play is the more they start to think about what kind of constituency context they're actually living in. So, you know, they might be a natural sort of Labour supporter, but then, you know, they start thinking, oh, well, actually, hold on, who won last time? Oh, yeah, it was a Conservative. And oh, who was second? Oh, let me check on Wikipedia. And oh, it was the Lib Dems. Okay, maybe I'll sort of lend my vote tactically. And that sort of thing really kicks into gear as the election approaches. And I think you can start seeing that in the polls and particularly in the YouGov MRP that was released last night. You can see a sort of a slightly more efficient distribution of the Lib Dem vote in particular, where people that were saying they were going to vote Lib Dem but live in places where the Lib Dems didn't have much of a shot, actually there's fewer of them now, and there's sort of slightly more in places where the Lib Dems are actually looking more competitive.
And regardless of whether voters are actually paying attention to some of these gaffes and misunderstandings that have happened this week, well, don't you think somebody from Boris Johnson's team should have prepped him a bit better in a more empathetic way to react to this photo of the young boy on a hospital floor?
Well, I mean, I think the Prime Minister and actually the wider politicians will be very aware that in this last week of the campaign, tiny things can take on great significance. And so whether or not you react badly to a photo on a phone or whether or not you don't answer a question properly, that can be inflated in the kind of final few days of a campaign. And I think both campaigns, actually, both leaders, Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson and various other leading figures from both main parties, probably haven't had the final week that they were hoping for. I mean, we had the Jonathan Ashworth thing yesterday where he clearly was caught out by the recording and had that excruciating media round where he was kind of forced to justify his comments and excuse them as just banter. So both main parties are suffering from that kind of last week set of nerves. And I suspect voters, while they will notice some of it, lots of their kind of underlying views will already be relatively set.
And Jen, Corbyn was quick to bring out a copy of the Daily Mirror that had that harrowing photo of the young boy in its front page. But some have suggested that all the way through this campaign, Labour could have attacked Tory mistakes a bit more strongly. Do you think they've done enough?
I think it's been a bit strange, to be honest. It's been a strange campaign on both sides, but it has been a strange campaign on the Labour side because it's felt to me as though they had their kind of prepared set of attack lines. You know, they've obviously been going in very hard with Trump on the NHS, but haven't necessarily been that fleet of foot in terms of responding to stuff. And I also think, like, I've been a bit puzzled, really, by the things that they have and haven't chosen to talk about. I've said this before, but I don't really understand why Labour haven't been talking about crime more. I know that they got caught out in 2017 with the numbers of police officers and all the rest of it, and it may be that they've taken the decision that they're not going to have Diane Abbott out there fronting up attack lines. But having said that, you know, for a lot of the voters in the kind of areas that we cover, crime is the thing that comes up again and again and again. And actually, often when we've spoken to people and we've said, what's your biggest concern at the moment? Once you kind of get past Brexit or maybe the NHS, crime is the next thing that comes up. And yet, because they're not hearing anything from Labour about that, they're kind of like, well, Boris Johnson's going to give us 20,000 new police officers. Like, that's the thing that they've heard about crime. So I think Labour have kind of clearly had their strategy from the get-go, and I think that there have been gaps in it in terms of going for the kind of voters that they need. And at the same time, maybe haven't done the best of jobs at responding to some of the failures on the Tory side. But I mean, in fairness to Labour, after the Boris Johnson stuff at Leeds General, there's no real way that they could have known that Jonathan Ashworth was going to make such a mess yesterday of screwing up their intended response, you know. And I heard somebody yesterday saying, like, if it's going to have any impact, the John Ashworth stuff, it has meant that Labour has kind of lost that momentum in the days running up to polling day, where they could have kept the NHS kind of top of the agenda and kept pushing it. But because of the John Ashworth stuff, obviously that scuppered it.
And Boris Johnson himself faced criticism for just not responding in to people as human beings after being shown that photo. Chris, what do you make of the importance of the leaders' characters during a campaign and how voters' opinions of them change? Because we saw in 2017 that people started off quite liking Theresa May and then opinions of her went down. How important is that in the way that they finally vote?
It can be very important. And I think one of the things for a lot of voters is that they're not really making the sorts of, calculations about policy outcomes and, oh, if it's a bit more money for this or a bit more money for that, what happens? A lot of voters are basing their decisions on heuristics. You know, is this person someone like me? Is this person someone cares about me, that relates to me, that sort of thing? And it can be quite decisive. And I think the really surprising thing here is that in 2017, we saw a very clear story where Theresa May didn't have a good campaign, and people the more they saw of her, the more robotic she seemed to be. And I think everyone thought that this time around, the Conservatives wouldn't have that problem because, you know, everyone thought Boris Johnson is this affable kind of chap. But the more the campaign's gone on, the sort of less that seems to be the case, and the more people seem to be reacting negatively towards him. It's hard to say, like, in terms of, it could be 1%, 2% of the vote and that sort of stuff. It's impossible to really make that sort of judgment because we never have the sort of opposite world where someone who isn't Boris Johnson has exactly the same policies as Boris Johnson and, but is slightly more friendly or reacts in a better way to the photo, for example. So it's hard to say for sure, but certainly the evidence we do have in political science suggests that these sorts of soft skills can be very important in voters' perceptions of leaders.
And one of the big themes of this election, Will, has been fake news and rumours and falsehoods and viral memes that are sort of spreading all over the place that aren't quite true. And there was this big furore on Monday when some Conservative advisers were suggesting that one of Matt Hancock's aides had been punched by a Labour activist, and then this quickly turned out to be not true at all. And it was widely circulated, including by some mainstream journalists. Do you think that there's going to be some chin stroking and reflection after all of this about the repercussions about spreading false narratives in elections?
So I just spent the last 2 days in Workington and Warrington talking to people on the doorstep and kind of in communities about how they feel about this general election. And the thing that struck me most from that experience was talking to people about their trust in politics. And it's clear that all parties and all party leaders suffer from some kind of deficit of trust amongst voters. And to some degree, lots of voters see this election as a choice between the best of a bad bunch. It's trying to find the least worst option. And I think that's especially true for the type of voters that will prove very influential in this election. So kind of former Labour working class voters who perhaps feel like the Labour Party has moved away from its traditional working class roots, but remain sceptical about making the leap to a Conservative Party, which historically has not been seen to be on their side. And I think trust is a huge part of that. And the way in which the media represents politicians' opinions and the way in which politics and the media interact has something to do with the fact that voters are increasingly untrusting of the political class. So there does need to be some kind of change, but it's not immediately apparent what could change in order to affect a kind of resurgence in public trust in politics. And I think it will take political leadership from individuals and people standing up and effectively holding themselves to a higher standard, and probably a better relationship between the lobby and politicians in particular, such that you don't get this kind of cycle of, as you say, fake news.
And I do think that it's pretty incumbent on journalism in the current environment to kind of do a little bit of self-reflection and kind of say, right, okay, well, if we are the bit here that it is supposed to be trusted, as opposed to viral Facebook posts or whatever, then maybe we need to be looking at how we go about covering politics. And I think after the 2017 election, after the Brexit referendum, and then also after the 2017 election, when the result was not what people expected, I think there was a bit of introspection within journalism. And I've kind of noticed a bit of a shift in terms of, you know, trying to get out to the regions, for example, and trying to be kind of a little bit more sort of even in the way that the country's politics is covered. So I think there has already been a response within journalism to the way that certain things have kind of shifted over the last 3 or 4 years. I think maybe there now needs to be a bit of introspection about this. On the political side, I agree that there does need to be some strong leadership where this kind of general issue of trust in politics is concerned, and it needs to be led from the front. Because what I've noticed during this campaign is that the more the public say that they don't really trust what they're getting from politicians, the more slightly sneaky some of the tactics have become. And that includes, you know, potentially briefing journalists that a Labour activist punched a Tory when they didn't, you know. And I think everyone needs to go away and have a think about that, because at the moment it's as though there's a spiral happening. Instead of things kind of ticking the other way to try and regain public trust, it's kind of like it's feeding off itself, and politics is just getting worse and worse and worse as a result. So I think kind of everybody involved in the game probably needs to have a bit of a think about that.
And Chris, we're not sure how much attention voters are paying to each of these individual gaffes. But in that case, what do you think has been the cause of the narrowing in the polls in the last 2 weeks or so?
For a lot of people, they see voting as something that they will always do. And when it sort of push comes to shove and they're like, oh, well, you know, I don't really like that party, but I really hate that party, then they sort of just have to lump for one of them, basically. And so part of that, I think, happened in 2017 as well, and I think it's happened again now, where there's people who are not particularly enthusiastic about Labour under Jeremy Corbyn, but actually they dislike the Conservatives under Boris Johnson even more. And so when push comes to shove, then they seem to be going towards Labour. And similarly, I think there's a few sort of Remain-leaning Conservatives who, you know, don't really want Brexit, not really happy with the way the Conservatives are going under Johnson, but they don't really want to risk a Corbyn government either. And so you see this flow back to the main parties, which becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, because, you know, they are the viable options. And so when push comes to shove, you have to sort of choose between a viable option. I think part of it is just, you know, when push comes to shove, people have to make a decision one way or the other.
And Jane, what about tactical voting in the election? Have you seen much evidence among the people that you've talked to that any Lib Dems are going to be lending their vote to Labour, or Labour will be lending their vote to the Lib Dem?
Yeah, we did a constituency profile of Cheadle, which is a Tory Lib Dem marginal, currently held by the Conservatives, but not by a huge amount. And certainly that was the seat where we've heard people saying, actually, I'd quite like to vote Labour, but there isn't really any point in me voting Labour, so I'm going to vote Liberal Democrat. That's the only area I've really heard people saying that. And the polls don't seem to suggest that the Lib Dems are going to be in with much of a chance of taking it. But obviously, you know, that we're all assuming that the MRP poll is going to predict everything as it did last time, and it won't necessarily. But on the ground in certain areas, particularly in that kind of more Remain constituency, then yes.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, we'll try really hard to imagine a post-election UK and whether or not we can come back from the negativity that this campaign has stirred up. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, at some point in the next 48 hours, we will know the results of the election. But what happens after that? Brexit will no doubt become the main topic of discussion again, and it's hard to see a time anytime soon when there might be harmony in the UK political system. Jen, despite both the Lib Dems and Labour wishing for the Tories to avoid winning a majority, at no point have we seen them try and compromise for the purposes of trying to get a second referendum. How messy do you think a hung parliament could be if that's the outcome on Friday?
Oh, just horrendously messy. Horrendously messy. I mean, you have to assume that we end up back in general election territory fairly quickly. I think there's a lot of hopes being pinned on, you know, this idea of there's a hung parliament is the only way that we're going to get a second referendum, etc., etc. But I think potentially it's kind of the route to that is a bit more complicated maybe than it's being portrayed by people who are trying to sort of suggest tactical voting in order to get to that point. From a personal point of view, you know, look, if we end up with a hung parliament, it's a little bit this kind of Boris Johnson attack line, isn't it? That, you know, we need to get Brexit done because there's so many other things that need sorting out, so therefore give us a majority. There's some truth in that. If we end up in another hung parliament situation, then all of the stuff that's drifted over the last few years has the potential to also continue to drift while another round of arguments happen about a second referendum. And we talked about trust before. You know, one of the things that's driving the lack of trust among voters is this sense that politicians have just been messing about. They've been in parliament, they've been arguing, and they've not actually been doing anything, whether that's Brexit or whether it's domestic policy stuff that they've noticed deteriorate around them. So, you know, if you do end up in another situation where people are just arguing again about whether to have a second referendum, I don't think that's going to particularly help politicians standing with, you know, people on the doorstep.
So we're looking at a deeply divided country here, Will. If the Conservatives were, say, the largest party in a hung parliament, is there any other party that they could turn to potentially to carry on governing? Or does it look far more likely that it would be a Labour minority government with some kind of rainbow coalition of the SNP, the Lib Dems, Plaid and the Greens as well?
I think it depends entirely on the parliamentary calculus post-election and the numbers that different parties get. It is possible that aside from the issue of Brexit, the Conservatives could have a supply and demand agreement with the DUP again. So clearly the DUP won't support Boris Johnson's Brexit deal, but they may support other activity, and that might allow the government to continue for a while. It raises the possibility of Boris Johnson potentially pivoting to a second referendum, which I think is very unlikely, but that might be one of the few options in that scenario. But I think overall, I think I agree with Jen that there is some truth in Boris's line that we need to get Brexit done to end the dither and delay. I do think the kind of delay that we have seen over the last few years and the kind of contest and division in Parliament will continue if we do have a hung Parliament on Friday. And that is a pretty bleak prospect for those of us who are trying desperately in the kind of Westminster bubble to try and come up with new policy ideas to move the country forward, because there is not very much political oxygen for very many other issues while Brexit is undecided and undelivered.
Jen, what do you think about the prospects of Labour working together with the SNP and the Lib Dems? Is that going to be possible while Jeremy Corbyn is still in charge, given that Jo Swinson, the Lib Dem leader, has said that she could in no circumstances work with him?
Yeah, I mean, Jo Swinson has changed her positions on a number of things. I mean, she was going to be Prime Minister at the beginning of the campaign, didn't she? I find it hard to see how that would work with Jeremy Corbyn still as leader. I also wonder whether there would even be all that much appetite from Jeremy Corbyn necessarily to continue in that scenario. Certainly talking to Labour people, you know, in the background, those preparations are starting to take place in terms of future leadership races and, you know, who's being manoeuvred and who's going to get whose support. So, I mean, could there be an agreement between a Corbyn-led Labour, the SNP, and Jo Swinson? Maybe, but I actually kind of find that scenario kind of unlikely. It feels more likely to me that Labour would probably get going on another leadership race.
But in that circumstance, who'd be the Prime Minister?
I don't know. You're asking the wrong person.
Anybody else? Will, who do you think in a hung parliament situation similar to 2017, who would be the prime minister then?
I don't know. It is a kind of terrible thought experiment because there are no easy answers, and history isn't necessarily a very reliable guide either. I mean, obviously in 1923, the last time there was another December election, the Labour Party formed a government with Liberal support, in which Ramsay MacDonald was basically a Labour prime minister with a Liberal cabinet. And so you could have some kind of Jeremy Corbyn-led government with strong Liberal Democrat representation in the cabinet, perhaps. I don't know.
Nicola Sturgeon? You could have Nicola Sturgeon as Prime Minister, couldn't we?
Well, Labour has said pretty categorically that they'd only run a minority government and it would have to be on a confidence and supply basis. So it's just up to whether the other parties, whether they'd go for that with Jeremy Corbyn in charge. And just looking back, Jen, at the seats where it looks like they could change hands from Labour to the Conservatives, do you think this is a one election anomaly where seats like Ashfield and Bolsover could go to the Tories? Might they switch back to Labour in the future once the issue of Brexit has been resolved?
I think once people have sort of made that leap from Labour to Conservative, they've sort of done it and they've broken that kind of tribal loyalty. I think one of the things that's worth watching maybe in this election is that in sort of traditionally Labour areas where the council has sort of recently started creeping towards the Tories, it's worth keeping an eye on those places like Bolton, places like Stoke, because if people have kind of ditched their tribal allegiances locally for whatever reason and then have gone over to the Conservatives in the local election, does that then make that almost kind of like a gateway to being prepared to do it in a general election? Having been out talking to voters, they've said, you know, I can't vote for Jeremy Corbyn. I want to vote Labour. But a lot of them have said, I can't vote Labour while Jeremy Corbyn is in charge. And you get the sense of people who would actually really much rather be able to just vote Labour as they normally would, because they don't really want to vote for Conservatives either. So it's, I mean, could those people go back to Labour in the future? I actually think yes, potentially. But it is dangerous territory for Labour to be in, where you're losing people who've never voted Conservative before and now they are. Like, that is dangerous. And I think if I was Labour, I would be worried about that pattern in some of their traditional heartlands, to be honest.
Chris, do you see evidence that these tribal loyalties are breaking down in the north of England in particular?
So we do, and there's a lot of different things going on. So one thing is that across the country, and for a quite long period of time, there's been a very steady gradual decline in levels of partisanship. So younger people have less sort of partisan views than older people, and as sort of generational replacement happens over time, the sort of electorate as a whole is less tribally loyal. And then on top of that, we have a lot of demographic sorting. So sort of younger people with university degrees tend to increasingly cluster in large cities, whilst the sort of populations of towns tends to be getting older, and perhaps people are moving there as they retire as well. And at the same time, politics is becoming increasingly divided by things like age and education. And so you've got a lot of things which are all working in the same direction towards these sorts of places that have been traditionally Labour are becoming demographically more and more favourable to the Conservatives, at least if politics continues in the way it is in terms of the demographic divides being age and education being the sort of most important ones. Now, I mean, that could change, of course. You know, if we get back into a politics where it's more about economic left-right kind of politics, then actually, you know, Labour might be finding themselves doing much better in these places. But I think so long as politics is being driven by these sorts of cultural divides rather than economic divides, then it's here to stay for the time being, at least.
And we've talked a lot already about trust and lack of it in the election so far. It's led to people talking more and more about proportional representation changing the voting system, feeling that they're not represented well. Well, can you ever see either Labour or the Conservatives bowing to such pressure to try and change how elections happen?
Well, we had this debate back in 2010 when the Liberal Democrats formed a coalition with the Conservatives and agreed on an AV referendum that was quite roundly rejected by the public in a referendum a few years ago. So we have dallied with the idea of moving to a more proportional voting system and rejected it before. I think it's possible if there was some kind of rainbow coalition with the Lib Dems and Labour for the Liberal Democrats to push a PR referendum as the price for their support in a coalition or some kind of supply and demand arrangement with Labour. But I think it's pretty unlikely. And I think it's also pretty unlikely to be supported by the public. I mean, I don't think the Liberal Democrats genuinely believe that they would get PR through in a referendum in 2012, which is one of the reasons why they went for AV. That was rejected. There isn't very much support that I have seen that the British public is kind of yearning for a more proportional system. People get first past the post. Actually, in places like London, where you have different systems, people can get quite confused. So I'm not sold on the virtues of proportional representation, but it is clear that the kind of the core virtue of first past the post, i.e. party stability and a kind of strong government, is diminishing over time, or at least appears to be. And if it continues, then perhaps that does change. I don't know.
Chris, do you think that the system is working as it is, given that we've had either very small majorities or hung parliaments for quite some time now?
Not really, to be honest. I mean, this sort of veers outside of my strictly academic view towards my personal views. But I think it's becoming increasingly clear that the electoral system is, you know, not working as intended. And I think one possible outcome tomorrow is that the Conservative vote share declines very slightly, but their seat share goes up very slightly, which would be the opposite of what happened in 2017, where their vote share went up and their seats went down. And if this link between changes in party support and changes in seats is non-existent or even reversed, there's, I think, something very, very wrong with the fundamental institution that is sort of, you know, behind our democracy. And I mean, I don't think there's much chance that we will change that, because the powers that be, you know, that have the power to control our electoral systems don't have an interest in changing them. And, you know, the Conservatives and Labour both benefit immensely from having a first past the post system. And unless that changes, and we've sort of there's a lot of research on this in political science that the electoral system tends to change when it's in the interest of one of the major parties. And so this is why you see a lot of PR systems coming into force at around the time that socialist parties first sort of start becoming an electoral threat in the sort of late 19th century. And unless, you know, either Conservatives or Labour start seeing it in their actual own interests to introduce PR, I think it's very unlikely that we would change that.
Jen, do you see evidence among voters that they're frustrated about the way the system's working?
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that has crystallised that is the very binary nature of the referendum. And obviously, which has then, in some respects, kind of then worked the opposite way, because, of course, the result hasn't played out as people who voted to leave were told it was going to. So you've kind of got a whole load of people, including many people in the EU referendum, who had either never voted or hadn't voted for a very, very long time, who had voted in something with a kind of binary outcome that they could understand, which has then not been delivered. And then they've got a first-past-the-post system where cause and effect isn't very clear. So I think you kind of combine those two things together, and it kind of overlaps with the issue of trust again as well. It's not just people don't trust politics, it's like they don't trust the system. And one of the senses that I've had while, you know, talking to people during this election is I wouldn't use apathy to describe the mood out on the streets. I don't know what other people have found. There is a real desire to vote for something that will actually deliver the thing that they're looking to deliver. But the problem is that the system isn't necessarily set up in that way. And so people are left very torn, very conflicted kind of loyalties, and kind of almost taken as a given that whatever cross they put in whatever box probably won't lead to the outcome that they're looking to get. And I think that's quite a dangerous kind of sentiment to be swirling around the electorate, to be honest, and quite ripe for exploitation by populism, of course, as well. So yeah, I think that the voting system is kind of tied up actually very much with the current kind of mood among the electorate and the kind of deep frustrations that have been coming out during the campaign.
And let's just finish with some predictions from you all. Chris, what do you think is going to happen on Friday?
I've spent the entire election campaign trying not to predict things, to be honest. Yeah. I think the most likely outcome is probably something that looks quite like the YouGov MRP, to be honest, so a sort of narrow Conservative majority. But I think it's very much still up in the air. I think we're in the sort of territory where a small polling error one way or another could lead to a very, very different outcome, or, you know, a small sort of change in people's vote intentions in a very small number of seats is the difference between a majority and a hung parliament. So, yeah, I think it's still very much up in the air.
Well,
I'm not going to predict the actual result, but what I will predict is that the two main parties will look very, very different after this general election than they did even in 2015. The Conservative Party is going to be significantly more working class, significantly higher number of people with lower levels of education, probably more white than it was in 2015, probably more male than it was in 2015. The Labour Party is going to become a lot more urban, metropolitan, I would suspect, possibly more middle class, more graduates in its makeup. And that has quite profound implications for our politics. It changes the fundamental perceptions we have about our two main parties and will change the dialogue between them as well. So I think the next parliament will be fascinating for how the two main parties adapt to their new voting coalitions, because it probably changes some of their policies.
And Jen, what's your final thought?
The MRP poll that came out last night felt instinctively more likely than the massive landslides that came through on the previous one. But I mean, YouGov themselves would highlight the fact that many of the seats within this are so close that, as Chris said, you know, just a very small number of seats voting in a slightly different way could have a kind of really decisive effect. I think my prediction will probably be around the Labour Party, which is that the same sort of debate that has been happening was happening on the fringes of the party probably 2014, as UKIP were kind of starting to become a threat in some Northern Labour seats at that point. The debate about who the Labour Party actually represents and whether it's a working class party or whether, you know, as Will said, it's kind of more of a kind of graduate middle class sort of metropolitan based party. I don't see any sign that that debate is going to go away. I think that is going to rage and rage and rage in the Labour Party. And I think one thing I do think that's worth looking out for is Labour piling up votes in the centre of cities. And this isn't a north-south thing, it's a kind of city-town thing, where, you know, I would expect Labour to do pretty well in more affluent Manchester seats, the heart of Liverpool, perhaps in central Birmingham, London, but then go a few miles down the road and you're starting to see seats where, if the Tories don't take them necessarily, they may well have eaten substantially into the Labour vote. And I think you're seeing a kind of change of the sort of landscape in terms of Labour's electoral coalition. And I don't think that that is a debate that's going to go away. I think it's quite an existential one for the Labour Party.
Well, it's not long now to find out what the result will be. That's all we have time for this week. Before we sign off, just a quick note to tell you to tune in on Friday, when we will be airing an extra special episode of our flagship daily, Today in Focus. The team will have been up all night to bring you the very latest in how constituencies voted, and you'll hear some familiar voices like that of political editor Heather Stewart. But for now, my thanks to all of our guests, Jen Williams, Will Tanner, Chris Prosser and Heather Stewart. The producer was Danielle Stevens, I'm Rowena Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.